Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal legal system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The Oregon Legislature's Joint Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response has held hearings recently on deflection programs, which have been put into operation to varying degrees in counties around the state in response to House Bill 4002, the measure that passed last session and repealed the decriminalization of simple possession of small amounts of some drugs, which was part of Measure 110. On Friday, March 7th, the committee held an informational hearing on deflection programs. This hearing was a special event held not at the Capitol Building, but at the Salem Convention Center as part of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission's summit. One of the witnesses at this hearing was Kenneth Sanjagren, Ph.D., Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Let's hear part of his testimony.
At the commission, we, since the initiation of deflection and since the initiation of the law changes in 4002, have been tracking data on our dashboards. And so what you'll be seeing here today is primarily data that we've drawn from our dashboards. And so you can go and look at any of these figures that I'm showing on the screen. We update them weekly, usually around Wednesdays. And so you can keep an eye on what's going on deflection statewide. So I'm going to cover all of the criminal justice system measures that we have, in addition to a little bit more of a deeper dive into deflection data during my presentation here for the next few minutes. So we're going to start at the beginning of the criminal justice process. We're going to look at PCS arrests that have occurred since the recriminalization of small amounts of drugs occurred on September 1st of this past year. I do want to note that when we're talking about arrest data, we at the commission are unable to separate out arrests for the new drug enforcement misdemeanor versus the old A misdemeanor or felony PCS arrests at that point. And so this is the entire universe of arrests that we're seeing post-recriminalization. So between the 1st of September, when recriminalization occurred, and the 5th of this month, we've seen just over 5,000 arrests statewide that have been logged into LEDS. Again, this is for all types of possession. Pre-COVID, we averaged around 300 arrests per week. Since recriminalization, the peak weekly numbers we've seen is at about 218. So we're not quite pre-COVID levels. We're at about, you know, the beginning of COVID levels here as far as PCS arrests are concerned. Around a quarter of all of those arrests are for standalone PCS, which means that they do not accompany any other charges at all. And the most common co-occurring crimes that we see, some of which were kind of mentioned by Dr. Waddell in her presentation, might be thought of as more commonly public order crimes, you know, trespass, failure to appear, theft in the second degree, and probation violations. And so we also have on our website, so for each of these different criminal justice system measures, we have just counts by county, so we can show where this action is occurring across the state. The most active county from the beginning of this process has been Jackson County. They've seen the most arrests, primarily in the Medford area, although we've also seen a high volume in the metro, like we would expect as we just do this breakdown across different jurisdictions. So the circuit court trends is what we'll talk about next. The line graph that we present here looks similar to what we had for arrests, but we are talking about a different universe of cases now. Once you get to the circuit court level, we can separate out the drug enforcement misdemeanors from A misdemeanors and felonies. And so what I'm displaying here is simply the drug enforcement misdemeanor cases that are being filed post the implementation of 4002. The comparison line that we have during between ballot measure 110 and the implementation of 4002, those are the e-violation tickets. We're trying to find something that is at least somewhat comparable over time so we can look at volume changes. Between the first of this year and the first of this month, or excuse me, between the 1st of September and the 1st of this month, we've seen around 3,100 drug enforcement misdemeanor cases. And so we went from those 5,000 overall PCS arrests to around 3,000 drug enforcement misdemeanors. Because these are just the drug enforcement misdemeanors, we do have a slightly higher share that are standalone DEM cases. It's about 53% currently. And so that is something that also looks very different compared to what we see at the arrest level. However, the most common co-occurring charges are similar to what we see with arrests. Again, we have those trespass twos, theft twos, and those types of crimes are the most common ones that we see when circuit court cases are filed. Now we'll move on to deflection. So the deflection numbers that we have are being tracked by our partners at OHSU, headed by Dr. Waddell, who we heard from just a moment ago. We utilize the REDCap data reporting system, which creates an individual record for each deflection referral that then is reported at least monthly back to the Criminal Justice Commission. And so what we're relying on here is what the counties have reported up. I do want to mention, however, that while grantees are expected to report monthly, it is still a new program, so sometimes there's a lag. And even when we say monthly, we don't mandate that anybody reports on the same date. And so we might have a little bit of a, you know, one program might put in a batch and the other one might do it maybe a week after we look at the data. So we're still early in this process, is just the note that I'm making here. So far, what we've had across all our deflection programs to date is 894, so almost 900 referrals made statewide for 841 people. We do have some folks who have had multiple referrals, as we'll see on the slide here. But overall, as far as volume is concerned, we're getting close to that 1,000 referrals. Although you can see that once we move from referral into actual program enrollment, we do see some drop-offs there as you move through this diagram. So we also have a quick map of where the deflection referrals are happening. We see some of our highest volume in Multnomah County, Yamhill County, as far as referrals are concerned, and then other counties are beginning to catch up. Some have just started. We see that some actually don't have any referrals yet. Most of those are much smaller counties who have not really ramped up their programs yet, and may be still in the planning stage. So the majority of referrals, as Dr. Waddell mentioned, come via law enforcement. I think that's by design, at least how the county programs are set up at the moment as law enforcement referral programs. We do see a small number of referrals coming from other referral sources, like Dr. Campbell will talk about in a few minutes. And I think that as it was even touched on by the question that we had earlier, there is some worry about how programs could incorporate other types of referral sources, and that's something we're hearing from our grantees. We heard it from the audience today, and so that's something that certainly we need to look into moving forward, given that what we've just heard in the best practice report, that you know these multiple referral approaches are what we should be aiming towards in the future. We also have data on the folks who are not completing deflection. If we went back to the Sankey diagram a few slides before, we saw that we had a number of folks who, as they come into the deflection program, they have most, in most cases, relatively quickly through non-engagement, they have not succeeded in that program. And so we have the different reasons here. There are more options in the REDCap data system, but we don't have a lot of data points in those other options, so we put up the most common ones here. Most program failures, as I mentioned, really seem to happen when folks are not able to or just decide not to engage immediately after referral. And so there are folks who either are lost and unable to contact after that initial deflection encounter, they don't engage with their treatment plan, or they voluntarily leave the program. I think importantly, most folks are not being disqualified for additional criminal involvement after the deferral, the deflection referral. It's mostly a non-engagement issue at this point. As far as referrals into services, we see that many individuals, they actually engage in services that cut across different domains. And so in many cases, they may actually be referred into multiple buckets here that we see on the screen. But for the most part, social services, SUD services, I think unsurprisingly, are the services that we see folks being referred into. As we move forward, we do collect much more detailed information as to the type of service folks are referred into. As we continue to get more numbers, then we'll provide more detailed breakdowns on our website.
That was Ken Sanchagrin, PhD, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, testifying March 7th before the Oregon Legislature's Joint Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response at an informational hearing held by the committee as part of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission Summit. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Another witness at this hearing was Christopher Campbell, Ph.D., an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University. Here's his testimony.
My name is Dr. Christopher Campbell. I am an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University. And I'm also the director of the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute there at PSU. And I'm also serving as a subject matter expert for the technical assistance that's operated, deflection technical assistance that's operated through the OHSU and led by Dr. Dan Hoover. So today I'm going to be talking about some of the ways to potentially expand participation in what we currently have going on with deflection, but then also talk about what it means to potentially expand our different pathways. And I'm trying to piggyback off of a lot of the great work that was just talked about by Dr. Waddell, as well as Dr. Sanchikin. So to give a quick roadmap, I'm going to start by summarizing some of the deflection efforts, highlighting some of these, a few of the statistics that Ken just talked about, but then switching back to how what this means for participation and expanding participation. Then I'll discuss some of the barriers that limit that participation, including officer buy-in and eligibility constraints. And then from there, we'll talk about what other pathways we could expand to, the challenges of those, and then what we have offering right now in terms of technical assistance. So Dr. Waddell and Dr. Sanchikin all already talked about what's going on in the state largely. Again, 27 different jurisdictions using or one is planning deflection currently. All of them are involving two primary pathways, and really it's just one is the real focus. Multiple, 18 of them have multiple different referral efforts, sometimes with a few other pathways sprinkled in here and there. The primary one is the officer intervention pathway. It's that overwhelming, that's the overwhelming majority of them, where we're holding a charge in abeyance over a defendant's head or someone who is potentially deflectable. The officer referral or prevention pathway is distinctly different in that there is no arrest option there. The idea is that you're actually coming across, the officer is coming across someone in their routine activities, and then you just offer them deflection. You seem like you're having a hard time. We would like to get you services. We have services available. Would you like to partake in them? It's really developing a lot of rapport with the officers and the public in that way. So across the 27 jurisdictions, there have been roughly 900 referrals, as Ken was just talking about, in 7 months since September. There have been 707 deflections among the 11 programs that began in September of 2024, which aligns with the CJC dashboard reporting on PCS arrests. These 11 deflection efforts have deflected about half of the 1,300 possible deflection events, which is crudely operationalized here as PCS-only arrests plus the referrals themselves. This isn't a perfect estimate, right? As some of the DA, there are a few jurisdictions that use DA diversion efforts, which I'll highlight, I'll show you where those kind of fall in this whole discussion in a moment. But it doesn't really capture when somebody gets arrested and then deflected after that, right? So it's a crude estimate, but it kind of gives us an idea as the potential leftover cases. So this kind of suggests that there is likely around 600 cases that were not deflected but could have been. This number highlights what I immediately think of is the potential officer buy-in issue, where we have had counties directly ask line officers what the barriers are, and many, several of these officers have indicated, it's like, well, I don't really believe in this. I don't think it's actually going to work. I don't know the process. So a lot of it is really legitimacy-based from the officer's perspective, which is pretty critical. I should note, though, that there are a lot of line officers who really do buy into this. They're very, very much on board with deflection. We've seen and heard from a number of them. But it's worth noting that there are still several out there in a meaningful circumstance, particularly in rural counties, who will say, I don't necessarily believe in this. So some work to be done there still. Mm-hmm. Sticking with the 11 programs that began in September, again, of 2024, we see that these 11 efforts have deflected about a quarter of the nearly 2,800 possible expanded deflection events, which again is crudely estimated here or operationalized as PCS arrests and co-charge arrests plus the referrals, the events themselves. So if we were to expand the eligibility to include individuals charged with the top four co-charges, which Ken was just highlighting in his presentation. So that's failure to appear, theft two, trespassing two, and then supervision violations. If we were to expand to those, we have an estimate of about 1,400 who were not deflected but could have been deflected. This is what I highlight as the eligibility issue, right? So a lot of jurisdictions are kind of hung up right now on whether or not we should really incorporate more charges, especially on the DA's level. They have a concern that some of these involve a victim. When you have criminal trespass or if you have a theft, there is a potential victim involved. What we're kind of suggesting here is that those should be open to the option of approaching the victim, if it's a business, for instance, and talking to that business and saying, we think that this defendant has an issue that we can address in another way so that this doesn't happen anymore. We could prosecute this person, but we could also address their issues, right? So we have a process to do that now. It's called deflection. Would you like to participate in that? What can we do to help? So about the six pathways that Dr. Waddell already efficiently went over, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on them, but I do want to highlight a couple of things. And one in particular is that there was a national study done by the BJA and the CHJ, there are national experts on deflection, and they highlighted that there are not just these six pathways, but of 321 organizations who they surveyed, only about 32%, so the least amount of or the lowest proportion of organizations actually engaged in the officer intervention pathway that Oregon primarily focuses on. So it's one of those things that a lot of jurisdictions went a different direction with. And it's worth noting, because what they tend to do is take a lot of these other ones, in addition to the officer intervention one, but they'll layer them. They will make them multiple levers that they can pull to try to deflect someone and keep them out of the system and address their needs, essentially criminogenic needs. So these are otherwise, we have to think about this as the self-referral thing. We have to think about this population as folks who would otherwise be in your jails or going through your court system or taking up time from patrol officers, calls for service, et cetera. But if we approach them and give them a self-referral pathway, if we give them another deflection effort that doesn't involve that limited resource, then we're minimizing the amount of time that we're dealing with them later. So aside from that, I want to highlight one of the most prevalent among these 321 organizations across the nation was the Naloxone Plus. And Naloxone Plus is specifically an outreach effort for folks who have just gone through an overdose. So that first 48 hours after an overdose, someone is most susceptible or receptive, I should say, of potential deflection efforts or treatment, right? So this is that key window when you can approach someone and say, you've just had a near-death experience. Can we help you? We've got services available for this. Would you like to talk to us? So when thinking about all these pathways, really, all the deflection pathways, is that they occur prior to the invoking of the system, right? That invoking of the system is just before actually filing charges, ideally. Or if you're holding a citation, then you're not moving on that necessarily, right? Any district attorney diversion efforts is actually invoking the system. It is a diversion tactic, right? Or a treatment court. These are different. These are procedurally different. The two highlighted there, again, are the ones that we primarily focus on in Oregon. So I wanted to provide a quick example of what this could look like in one of our counties. I chose Multnomah County. I had the data quickly available, so I went ahead and went with it. And from this, I put together a graph that was created using LEDS data. The CJC folks provided a great overview of a lot of the data that's available through the CJC. But this includes the law enforcement database system, LEDS, the Oregon Health Authority, and then, well, that's not the CJC, but the Oregon Health Authority is in this as well. And then the Oregon Judicial Department data is also in this as charges filed. So it essentially shows that monthly counts, this graph here shows the monthly counts of five different metrics that we try to use when thinking about drug use. And what we use, my colleagues and I used in our study of Measure 110 that the report will recently be made public. So the takeaway from this is that candidates, some of the best candidates for self-referral or naloxone plus are those who recently interacted with the healthcare system due to drug-related issues. So that highlighted here are the hospitalizations and emergency room visits specifically related to drug issues coming from the Oregon Health Authority. This is specific to Multnomah County in these given months. So imagine that we engage these folks in a naloxone plus scheme. And the idea here is we're trying to bring them into our deflection networks that are already created for this in the anticipation that they're going to be potentially coming across officers later. If we just basically successfully pull in 10%, we're pulling in, according to this graph, roughly at least 60 people a month into the deflection efforts. So that's substantially increasing participation in the efforts that you all are creating as foundations, right? So that's just self-referral or naloxone plus. This might require coordinating with local hospitals, right? And having the local hospitals become a bit of a spearhead in a little bit of the discussion there. Focusing on other pathways, and this is in addition to what we already have, which is the officer intervention and some officer referrals, are the pathways of active outreach, where you have a team or a co-responder model, where you have a team of folks who are actively going out and finding folks who either often come in contact with the system, but they aren't currently, or maybe houseless individuals who they know who are struggling with substance use disorder. To give you an idea of what that capacity might look like, we can look at Measure 110 data most recently, and then before the pandemic, you can look at the defelonization era. What were the PCS charges looking like during that frame? Those are probably the folks that you're going to come across, especially if they had multiple during that time frame. So to begin the wrap up here, challenges for expansion of not just our current pathways, but the other types of pathways I mentioned. Some of them I want to highlight are logistics and funding, right? So if you want a self-referral process or anywhere in which someone can be dropped off or can drop in to connect with your treatment services, you have to have a staff site. That site has to be there. There has to be someone physically there to receive people, right? A lot of rural places, this isn't always feasible, which kind of ties into the transportation issue with a lot of rural places. If you have one, then it could help a lot. And then you also have the transportation. That could help a lot. So I know some rural counties are talking about maybe we could use some of the funds if the funds were available, to hire just a transport person, you know, for the healthcare purposes. So they're going to go out and meet officers or meet folks and then bring them to this particular site. And that's their sole job. I will note that there was a program, a deflection program studied in Illinois, in rural counties specifically, that were not really all that close to the specific drop-off or drop-in location. And they were able to secure some type of transportation. They incorporated over 80 referrals and self-referrals in particular in a year. So just imagine what you've been able to do in 7 months for those rural counties that have been working since September. And then think about if you could have had 6 more per month, essentially, or 7 more per month, that could be really beneficial and really kind of utilize all the resources you're putting together. The officer role I want to highlight specifically is that we have these intervention models. They shouldn't be abandoned by any means. They should be strengthened and supplemented, right? Supplemented by other pathways. And not only that, if you're going to address the officer buy-in problem, the officer buy-in issue in a lot of jurisdictions, then you need to have open communication. There were some folks yesterday who were talking about going to the briefings. I've been talking about this a lot. I often say roll call, but briefings are it. That's the time. Go and meet them at that time if you're a deflection counselor or a specialist, and you get to talk with them, have FaceTime with them. It means a lot, right? Not only that, but the follow-up is critical. So that's the act of communication and interaction. And then lastly there is identifying goals. A lot of folks, I think a lot of jurisdictions are thinking, we're just gonna do this because House Bill 4002 is there and we do it now. I don't think there was a lot of discussion of like, what are the goals of our county and jurisdiction? Do we have if we have a serious overdose problem, you should really think about Naloxone Plus, adding it to your repertoire. It's just another tool in your tool belt to really expand this. If you have a serious houselessness issue, then active outreach is your thing. You get to know them really well. And it can be in conjunction with officers if it's a co-responder model, but it doesn't have to be, right? You can all be working towards the same goal. So the last things that I'll mention is that we do have this technical assistance going on. It is going on, currently funded through May of this year. There's a number of things that we've been doing for this. For example, some of the activities include coaching discussions. We have regular meetings with several of the technical the folks who are engaged in technical assistance or counties engaged in technical assistance, trying to give them best practices, talking about best practices a bunch. We're also helping them operationalize what does it mean for success. We're helping them think through a lot of these things. And then also highlighting not necessarily training, I don't want to call it training, but it's more like lessons learned. What are other counties doing? What are they learning? And we're trying to bring it to then other counties. So we'll have these webinars that we'll often record called Echoes. And then we try to make those available as much as possible. While we've had some attrition since July, so we started about 25 counties working with the technical assistance. Today, we're working with 15 one-on-one, but there's still 20 that's observing a lot of our echoes that we record and then make available. So counties are still engaging in the technical assistance. It's gaining a fair amount of attention, but I think it could probably be utilized a little bit more. So in closing, as deflection efforts ramp up in Oregon, its impact is currently limited by narrow eligibility criteria and the over-reliance on officer discretion. But it's really looking promising, as Dr. Waddell kind of highlighted, and as did Ken. Things are looking very strong. And by expanding eligibility and incorporating new pathways, we have the potential to really capitalize on this infrastructure that you all are putting together.
That was Christopher Campbell, PhD, an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University, testifying March 7th before the Oregon Legislature's Joint Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response at an informational hearing held by the committee as part of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission's summit. And for now, that's it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long!